This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 24 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
David, this week we have a mixture of news stories and an interesting proposal from one of our listeners, one that we hope will spark some good conversation.
Yeah, well, we definitely have an active listener core, and we want to encourage that. So tonight is going to be a discussion. We're going to present something from one of our listeners out to the rest of you, and we definitely want your feedback. But tonight's topics, of course, will touch on the big news of the week, which was the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol grounded their fleet after losing one of their Predator Bs off of San Diego. We'll talk about a proposal for a UAS licensing and permitting plan. We'll talk about quadcopters filming whales, and that story actually comes from a special listener in our audience. And last but not least, an article that popped up today about drinking and droning and how the FAA doesn't want people doing that. So I guess we should take it away with our first story, huh, Max?
Sounds great. Let's get started.
Well, this week, the U.S. Border and Protection Agency grounded its drone fleet. For those who don't know, the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Organization, or the CPB, have Predator Bs. Now, Predator Bs are demilitarized versions of what's commonly known as the MQ-9 Reaper. And they are flown by the CPP Office of Air and Marine. Well, evidently, we ditched one in the Pacific Ocean off of San Diego this week due to a battery failure.
Yeah, I guess that we don't have the full analysis done yet, certainly, but it appears that the onboard generator stopped working. Now, I guess this craft has a backup battery, but the power wasn't enough to get the Predator B all the way back home. And so the decision was made to dump her in the Pacific.
And of course, this is a big deal. And the FAA and the National Transportation Safety Board were notified. Now, the Wall Street Journal reported that the National Transportation Safety Board hadn't decided if it would open an investigation. Now, Max and I are fortunate enough to have an insider into the National Transportation Safety Board. And we reached out to our friend and recent guest on Airplane Geeks, Bill English, for a comment about, as he's one of the lead investigators for the National Transportation Safety Board. And surprisingly, Bill's was a very direct comment, and that was...
He said, yes, there will be an investigation from the NTSB. He says that per part 830 and 1132, this is a non-military public aircraft operation, and there was substantial damage to the airframe with a gross takeoff weight greater than 300 pounds, so that qualifies as an accident in the eyes of the NTSB, and therefore there really is no decision to be made. Yes, the NTSB will be investigating that. And Bill even mentioned that he's going to be the investigator in charge. So it'll be great to follow along and learn from Bill as he's able to give us more information about the investigation.
We were fortunate enough to deal with Bill. Bill was the lead investigator on the Asiana crash, and we couldn't talk to him while the investigation was going. Once they issued the results, Bill was able to come on the show and talk about the investigation. Bill has wrote the book per se about UAVs and crash investigations, so I guess this will be his first real test on that. He also did comment that the stand down by the CPB was self-generated, not by us or by FAA. us being National Transportation Safety Board. But as they model their safety programs on the military, that's not uncommon. So it sounds like the CPB is just having a safety stand down, which in the military is not uncommon. If something like this happens where it's a loss of electrical power or engines or something, they will ground the fleet to do checks to make sure that there isn't a persistent problem.
Yeah, and that maybe happens more often than you might see in the commercial world, I think. And so for that reason, the news story is important and interesting, but the fact that the entire fleet was grounded, as you say, David, that's not really big news. It's not the big news part of this. It's just an effort to make sure that safe operation continues and that they understand what the problem is before flying other aircraft and just being conservative. So there we have it.
I will say one other thing that blew my mind this week about this story.
And what's that?
Well, finally we have a story where I would actually accept the fact that they would show either a Predator or a Reaper as the photograph involving the aircraft. Instead, one of the news organizations used a Global Hawk. It just blows my mind again. You know, even if they had used a Predator, since they call the CPB calls the Reapers a Predator B, I would have been okay with that. But the fact that they used a Global Hawk for the article, it just blows my mind.
Well, hopefully someday they'll get it right.
I doubt it, because this just proves that they're going out of their way to get it wrong. So we got an email from Tim Trott. From Tim Trott Productions, and based on our discussion with Manny, which we've gotten a lot of feedback on, and he's wrote out a phase permitting plan.
Yeah, this is something that presumably many people are thinking about, looking at, and is probably where we need to end up. And in this case, Tim has defined a number of different classes for UAVs and looks at airframe type, weight, altitude, a number of different factors associated with each class, or a number of different characteristics for each of those classes, and is proposing what are the training requirements, insurance requirements, and things like that. So this is very interesting, very topical. And so David and I, when we saw this, thought that it'd be worth going over this with you all, our audience, and then asking for comments, suggestions. What are ways to improve this? Is it completely off base? What would you add? And let's see if we can generate amongst the community here something that might have some substance and maybe is useful as an input to a decision-making process. So we have these classes, and I think we'll run through them. We'll, of course, put more details about these in the show notes for this episode. So, in fact, if you've got a computer in front of you, not if you're driving, you can visit the show notes for this episode, maybe follow along. But we have these classes, Class A through E, E being the smallest class, Class A being the largest class, and then an observer class. So, David, why don't we kind of go through these quick? We can start at the bottom, we'll call it the bottom, the small class, Class E, the experimental and photographic class.
What Tim is suggesting for this is for the Class E, experimental photographic, it's an under 5-pound visual line of sight only, under 100 feet above terrain. You must have insurance. You can only fly over private property, no public areas. You can have no spectators within 25 feet. There's an observer required. Airframe certification form, logging, multicopter for small UAVs only. Insurance required, AMA, which is the Academy of Model Aeronautics, or better. A safety test written, and a level E proficiency flight test. Interim 1-year temporary permits pending full rule implementation. So, Max, this is geared towards you and your little quadcopter, huh?
That's right. You know, in looking at this and just talking about Class E for just a minute, The first thing I thought about was under 5 pounds, and kind of where does that fit in the spectrum? So I went and looked at the DJI Phantom webpage where they give the specification as it being 1,000 grams, and that's roughly 2.2 pounds at a GoPro or a camera or something like that. And that it seems reasonable that for a small class, 5 pounds kind of seems to fit the bill.
It's a hobbyist. When he says AMA or better, we're talking about someone like yourself who wants to go fly a quadcopter and fly it around his house and basically isn't going to do anything commercial with it. It's just a hobbyist.
Yeah, and the one thing that I might add to the thinking on this is it seems like there would be some differentiator between Class E, this sort of thing, and sort of a toy classification. It seems like there's very small, some people call them toy quadcopters and things that are even kind of below this. I mean, I'm not sure that you'd require insurance and testing and so forth for some of the the toy quadcopters you see at the shopping mall and places like that. So I guess that would be my input to this class, is adding some kind of floor below which you'd consider it to be a toy classification that has no requirements. That's Class E. Next, going up the scale, we have Class D, motion picture, corporate, news, and journalist kinds of uses. You want to describe that a little bit, David?
Under 20 pounds, but I guess greater than 5 pounds. Again, visual line of sight only, limited to 400 feet above terrain unless a flight plan is filed and approved. So definitely we're moving into a more structured thing. Mm-hmm. Insurance is required, private property only, public areas with a permit, an observer required, no spectators within 25 feet, fixed wing or multicopter small UAVs, an airframe certification form, logging a written safety, which is the written test again, and the level D proficiency flight test. So we're definitely talking about, this is more into a commercial world. We really weren't talking about fixed wing in Class E, but now we've entered fixed wing and multicopters and journalists. So where do you think we are with this, Max?
So we're moving up the scale. And this kind of seems to make sense to me as sort of the next level. We might mention at this point that one characteristic of all these classes is a safety test and a proficiency flight test. And what Tim had in mind for a proficiency flight test is something that could be administered by a designated certification instructor or a licensed flight instructor. So there's some more structure to this. And the safety test, he says that's something that would be comprised of a series of questions relating to things like the 400-foot height limits, the knowledge of the 500-foot limits for manned aircraft, restrictions related to airports and heliports, spectator distance, VLOS requirements, observer requirements, and so forth. Minimum flight distance from utilities, highways, railroads, buildings, and rules like that. So that's a little bit about the safety test and the proficiency flight test that are part of each of these classes. So let's move up to Class C, which is agriculture and industrial.
And Type C is under 25 pounds, but pretty much it's the same requirements as Class D, only there's going to be an observer required, no spectators, fixed wing and multicopter, an airframe certification logging required. This is something that we're adding where you're logging your flight times, so and the written test and the flight test. One of the other things Tim suggested about the flight test was there are basically the manufacturers now are coming up with recommendations on how to test fly their aircraft, and that could be the standard in which you could prove competency flying your quadcopter, etc.
And another aspect of Class C here is that now he introduces first person view. supervision. So we are getting above visual line of sight only in the first two classes, D and E. And in Class C now, we're starting to see first-person view.
And that's important in agricultural because as the agriculture comes along, we're talking about larger chunks of land. The agribusiness wants to use them to cover large amounts of crop zones. So you're not going to be able to have a line of sight if you're sending it a quarter of a mile down your farm.
Sure.
So that's why the first-person vision with an observer is important for to make that distinction.
And I'm also thinking that in industrial or inspection kinds of missions, where you might send the quadcopter up there to inspect a tower or something of that sort, you know, I think first person view is going to be a more effective and accurate way to guide the craft than standing at the bottom and, you know, trying to see how close am I to the structure I'm trying to inspect. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
And that leads us into type B when we were talking about utilities. You want to go into that?
Yeah, public safety, utility kinds of uses, examples being fire rescue, public safety, pipeline, waterway monitoring, things like that. And so Tim's proposal is under 30 pounds here, first-person view supervision, still under 400 feet above terrain, above 400 feet with a filed flight plan. Again, no spectators within 25 feet. Could be public airspace or private airspace, fixed wing or multi-copter UAV, FAA review required. And now something that's, again, new with this class is some sort of collision avoidance system required. And then the usual things that apply to the others, logging required, a written safety test, a level B proficiency flight test. And he also adds a commercial or private pilot rating accepted in lieu of a written test.
So what he's saying is that this kind of first-person view, you could avoid the test by being a pilot. So he's acknowledging the sophistication of something that would be flying a pipeline or used for fire spotting, or like they used the Predator in California this year, etc. So it's definitely a commercial private pilot rating. We are definitely getting serious about the skill levels and the knowledge base for this kind of commercial use.
And I like the fact that he's starting to blend that experience from the sort of existing manned flight world. I think that it would be unwise if we all were to sort of treat unmanned vehicles as something completely separate, completely new, with no relationship to manned flying. Certainly, if you say, well, who are the experts at flying? It's the people that have been doing that for all these years. So to link this to that, I think makes a lot of sense to me. And there's a lot of value in doing that. We don't need to create something completely in parallel, separate, distinct from private pilot flying and that sort of thing. So now moving up to Class A, the heavy class, examples being sort of state, municipal, and federal agencies. And these are over 30 pounds in this proposal, and similar otherwise, first-person view, under 400 feet or over with a filed flight plan, insurance, tracking, observer, spectators. It's pretty much the same. Different level proficiency flight test, something commensurate with level A aircraft, and a commercial pilot rating accepted, again, in lieu of the written test. So the final class is Class O, the observer class, which is kind of a different thing. And that's just simply that to be an observer, to satisfy the requirements of those other classes, it just requires a basic safety test. So the idea is that as an observer, you wouldn't just, pull some kid off the street and say, hey, watch me while I do this, and that satisfies the requirement. The observer would be required to have some basic knowledge of this area. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
And in all fairness, probably you could get your observer certificate automatically if you've passed one or more of the levels, that you could be an observer for that level if you pass the certification. So you can think of it that way.
Yeah, good point. Very good point, David. So again, this is a proposal. Tim does video marketing, and so he's very interested in using the capabilities of UAVs as part of that, and sees the value in that. And I think his motivation is to try to advance the conversation so that we get closer to the point where we can do more commercial activities with unmanned vehicles. So again, we invite comments, input, criticisms, constructive, hopefully, from all of you listening. And you can do that in a couple of ways. You can either add your comments to the post for this episode, or which is episode 24, or you can send us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com, and let's see if we can have a little conversation about that.
And we definitely want to hear from you. So just to reaffirm, either do the post, which is real easy, or you could do feedback. If you don't want to have your name mentioned or such, just you can always leave it anonymous or send us the email. We will be happy not to share it. But we definitely want to have a conversation, and maybe we need to revisit this on a semi-regular basis. Because, like we've always said, we want to be the ones monitoring ourselves, not having the FAA tell us what to do and not having a clue. So we're taking the first step to standardizing UAVs. What a concept.
Very good. All right. We've got a couple of other news stories we want to touch on, David. The first one comes from, guess who? Mrs. Flight. I was just amazed because normally she doesn't pay a lot of attention to this sort of thing, but I think some of this is rubbing off on her. And so she forwarded an article in Grind TV. It's titled, "Is Whale Watching with Drones the Next Big Trend?"
Yeah, a California whale watching organization used a quadcopter to create a video of a whale at sea. Yes, it's whale watching, and yeah, that's kind of cool, but I think it sort of defeats the spirit of getting out in the sea and feeling the spray and going out and seeing whales. But it's another good use of, first person view. You could stand on the shore, and where I go down the shore in Jersey, there's always a pod of dolphins right off the shore, and it would be kind of cool to have a tiny little hexacopter with a camera and me stand on the beach and watch the dolphins play in the water. So it's a neat application. So, and of course, Max, it was using guess what quadcopter?
From the video, looks like another DJI with a GoPro hanging from it.
Boy, talk about the ubiquitous UAV now.
Right, but everywhere. It's interesting also that there are some other considerations here. We talk about what's it going to take to allow commercial operation. But that's not the only issue, and it comes out in the article. There's something called the Marine Mammal Protection Act, for example, which makes it illegal to harass or alter the behavior of marine mammals. Also, NOAA has whale watching guidelines, or just guidelines, not requirements, but that they suggest that boaters keep 100 yards away from whales and that planes and helicopters stay 1,000 feet above. So the question is, now we've got a quadcopter. How does that apply? Do we just take the existing rules and apply them, or are they different? Does the quadcopter harass or affect the behavior of whales? I think in this case, they were about 50 feet, according to the article, above the whales that they were filming. Lots of questions, lots of issues. So here again, I think we see, this new technology being used or being contemplated. And when you start to think about what are the issues, sometimes there's a lot of issues to consider.
Yeah, and one of the other things the story brings up is recently off the coast of Norway, a quadcopter was used to film killer whales swimming around kayakers. So there's a lot of people thinking the same way, and it's an old school observation point. point. And as for the Marine Mammal Protection Act, off the coast of the Jersey Shore, when the dolphins start swimming up to the beach, for all intents and purposes, the lifeguards call everybody in to maintain that 100 yards away from the... So it's not surprising that all of a sudden it's a beautiful, clear day and the lifeguards in Wildwood are calling people into the shore. And that's because the pod of dolphins are off the shore and they're trying to keep the NOAA regulations. So it's not surprising. But from whales and whale watching and sitting on the beach to a nice cold can of beer that on the beach, we got an email from one of our listeners, Bill, who said, quote, "The creative minds of the world will continue to want to employ new technologies in ways you and I would never think of. That is why this is such an exciting time, or at least it will be when creativity like this can be unleashed." And we have the FAA interceding in another unique organization, unique product.
Yeah, another delivery system squashed. So we have this microbrewery, Lake Maid. And what they were doing was they were delivering, I guess, 6 packs of beer to ice fishermen via multicopter. The FAA caught wind of that and said, no, 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 you can't do that. Now, to be honest with you, David, I've never really understood ice fishing. I mean, it's the middle of the winter. You're sitting on frozen ice, sometimes just out in the open, but more often you see them in a little shack. And the logic escapes me. I could only imagine that was just a way to get, away from your wife for a period of time and contemplate, I don't know, something.
I don't know, but have you seen some of those ice fishery houses?
They're serious little shacks.
Well, they're serious man caves.
That's right.
Let's face it. We have our man caves, and we're both fortunate to have wives that let us go play in our man caves. But yeah, and their poor fishermen are out there in the cold, and all they want is a beer. And here we have a perfectly good delivery system to get that cold beer out to that ice house, and the FAA has decided that that's not a good idea.
I was impressed also that these quadcopters. Oh, actually, I think they were hexacopters. They were multi-rotor. They were more than four rotors, but I was impressed with the load carrying capability. I was trying to figure if that was a 6-pack or a 12-pack that those things were carrying, but in either case, it's more than just one bottle of beer. So they were lifting some significant weight to the fishermen out there. And I think that I also saw what I thought was a camera attached to the copter. So I guess they're doing first-person view. I imagine they are to make these deliveries, or they were until the FAA put a stop to it.
Well, it is kind of funny. You have the multicopter come up to you with your case of beer, and I guess you flash your driver's license into the camera so they can record your age to make sure that you're the proper age to be drinking said beverage, and then maybe flash your credit card to them so you can get charged for. I actually think this is a brilliant idea, and I'm really disappointed that the FAA is not going to allow these people as an exception to,
Yeah.
I mean, if it was hot chocolate, they wouldn't be upset, but,
I'm not sure. All right, well, I think that'll do it for this episode of the UAV Digest. As always, you can visit the UAVDigest.com for show notes, links to the news articles we mention, in this case, the proposal for the different UAS classes. And again, have a look at that. If you want to follow us on Twitter, David, where can they go?
On Twitter, it's at UAV Digest. On Facebook, it's facebook.com, UAV Digest. On Google Plus, it's UAV Digest. And of course, feedback at the UAVDigest.com is the email for you to send all your responses. Again, we'd like to thank Tim for giving us the opportunity to show his proposal. And also, we want to give a shout out to Go Engineer, and we'd like you to go to the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. We're very happy to have them as a sponsor, and we would like you to take a look at what they do for the UAV industry as well as their 3D printing. So I guess that'll be it. And until next week, this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
So long.